All right, tonight's learning is sponsored by Anonymous for Zechus Refuah Shleima for Baruch Ben Chanabasya. May our learning and brachos be a Zechus for his Refuah Shleima. So welcome to those who are new. Welcome back to those who have been here before. As mentioned and advertised, each session is a separate topic. It's helping to think about, hopefully, as we are all working together at being better parents and better mechanchim in our families. And I make the same caveat every single time, which is, I am by no means an expert. The expert is sitting next to me. And also in front of us, Rav Shlomo Volbe doesn't need another introduction, but that's really what we're learning together. And this is an opportunity for each of us to reflect on the things that maybe we do without thinking, things we haven't really thought about in a long time. And our topic this evening is something that brings me back. Someone knocking? I hope they can just come in. No one needs to worry about
Someone's there. I didn't hear anything.
Oh, maybe I misheard something. Okay. I made that up. Eliyahu Navi. Okay. So it reminds me, when I was studying psychology in undergrad, I took two courses, one after the other. One of them was social psychology, and one of them was personality psychology. Anybody here studying psychology in undergrad? Either social psychology or personality psychology?
That much I can't remember.
That much you can't remember. The details escape you.
I think I was studied.
You're right, right. You were in the class like electrical shock under your seats, right. You were a subject in the matter. But I remember for each professor, they gave the same caveat that there's a great distinction between social psychology and personality psychology. Social psychology takes people and says, why is it that people who are very different, different culturally, different economically, different ages, gender, why are people acting the same way in certain situations? People respond in terms of conformity, in terms of obedience, in terms of peer pressure. Why do different people act similarly in certain situations? Personality psychology asks the opposite question. Why is it that in the same situation, certain people act differently? Which is what we might call temperament, right? A person's underlying nature. And that is really the topic for this evening, to understand more about the role that the individual nature of a child plays. A lot of these ideas are, it sounds like one size fits all, which we're obviously never going to say. But some of these ideas are, this is good for a child, it's good for a child when we say this. But we have to get into the issue of, obviously children are different. Not just between one child and one family versus another family, but even children in the same family, even twins, which we have the experience of working with, even twins who share a birthday, but sometimes it feels like nothing else. And very often there's this temptation to apply this one-size-fits-all model. I've used a line before, I've used this many, many times, and people say, oh, twins, two for the price of one. It's two for the price of three. Sometimes it's like doubly hard because you're trying the same things and then you have to walk it back when you realize that this same tactic works for one and not the other. We tried potty training them at the same exact time. One was ready and one was not, which was a big mess for the house. But that was something we had to realize. Just because they have the same birthday doesn't mean that they're any more necessarily geared toward the same type of parenting or the same type of treatment than the other. The age-old question in psychology is nature versus nurture. Remember this at least, right? Nature versus nurture. That you remember. Nature versus nurture. That was the first day of class. After that, who knows what was talked about after that. But nature versus nurture. And one of the ways that they study nature versus nurture, the effects of the child's internal temperament, for example, versus the environment that they're in, is they look at identical twins who are raised apart. And this is a sad story. Twins who were in foster care and split up, and they figure out what ways genetics plays a role, even though they were raised differently. And sometimes for fraternal twins, like our girls are, they look at the home and they say, well, the environment is the same, because they're getting the same parents and the same schooling, but the DNA are totally different. They're siblings, but they're not really necessarily, they have some overlapping genetical factors, but by and large, they're totally different kids. I actually disagree with that. I disagree that fraternal twins is a good example where their nurture is the same, but only the natures are different. Sometimes when a kid is very different, they pull for a very different nurture. The way that we may speak to one child is very different than the other child based on their temperaments. If one's a little bit more cranky, one's a little bit more needy, then the parenting that we give them may also be a little bit different. So I would argue that sometimes even the nurtures change as the natures are changing. But think about the roles that not only the child's temperament has on their own learning and how they process and internalize and feel and all kinds of stuff. We have to recognize that it really changes the environment. Teacher doesn't relate the same way to a child whose needs are such and such, or whose temperament is more passionate, more angry, more loud, more jumping on the table. So we really have to think about some of these ideas. So Rav Volbe has a beautiful essay. So it's on the third page of your packet. We started this last time. It's a new topic for tonight. On page Yud Ches, on page 18 on the bottom, should be the third page. The heading is Hit'ama Ishit, which is a personal fit, personalized chinuch. He writes, Davar nosaf shehaorim tzrichim liyos mudaim, a love. Another thing a parent really has to pay attention to, hu hakaras hayeled im techuno sav hapratiyot, to recognize the child's individual nature, to recognize the child's individual personality, to understand what their needs are. Ein yeled dom lechaviro, one child is not the same as the other. Im hahorim einam yodim zos, so if parents don't know this, and don't know this could mean they're not aware of this, or that they know this intellectually, but they don't operate under this assumption. When a parent attributes to a child talents or abilities or skills that they don't have. Your brother is always good at math, we're signing you up for the math club. What if this kid doesn't excel at math or likes math but doesn't necessarily find a passion in it? Your sister's doing dance, so you're doing dance. They're going to do gymnastics together. At some point they're young, they don't know what they like. We don't know what they like, that's fine. But as they get older, is there an assumption that your older sibling went to this school, so you're going to this school, or this camp, or this activity, extracurricular, or this profession. Certain families are doctors. We had someone here on Shabbos who may have parents who are maybe doctors and was putting on a stethoscope, and we said, no, do something else. No. But there's no pressure either way, but it's interesting to think about certain professions run in the family, and there's nothing wrong with that. And certain times, parents may assume a kid doesn't want to do something, maybe it is a good fit to slide right in, and sometimes it's not a good fit for the kid, and the kid feels pressured. Obviously not in your case. I'm just speaking hypothetically. But sometimes we attribute to a kid either talents or abilities or recreational activities that we assume they like because we like them or their siblings like them or their peers like them. Hachinuch v'ha'amel sheheim mashki'im lo yamchuvan klal el oso yeled. And the education and all the work we're putting in is not really directed at them. There's a famous line, Chanoch l'nar al pidarko. We've heard this before? Who said this? This is the slogan of Hank. But also, originally said by Shlomo HaMelech, Chanoch l'nar al pidarko, educate a child according to his way. And the end of the pasuk is, Gam ki yazkin, even when the child grows older and matures, lo yasur mimen, the child will not deviate from that education. The idea is to educate a child according to his derech, according to his or her way. What does that mean? Rav Volpe says, Bertzoni l'chanecheled, if I want to do a good job educating my child, alai l'hesponein v'livdok mahi darko ha'ishit, I need to not just ask, what do I want to teach? But what does the child fit to learn? What is the child, misugal, what are they geared towards? Dvar muvan hu she siach habanana, that's a Hebrew word for banana, sarach tipul acher me'asher eitz hatapuach. A banana bush requires different care than an apple tree. The name of the sefer is Zrio Binyan Bechina, we mentioned in the earlier topics, about analogy of planting and building. If you want to use the analogy of planting, you can't treat plants all the same way. Now, I'm no botanist, I don't actually know the difference between these things, but he says, Im nigadel siach bananot ve'etz tapuchim v'nanik l'shnehem tipul zahav. We give identical treatment to a banana and an apple growth. L'pachot echad mehem lo yigdal tov. At least one of them is going to go off. One of them is not going to grow properly. V'ulai shnehem gam yachav lo yatzmichu pri. Maybe they'll both flop. Because if we're giving one-size-fits-all care toward growth without really delving into the diagnostics of why would this one need something else, more sunlight, more water, more soil, more this, different seasons, they're totally different things. And he says, kach, gam im iladim. Same thing is true with children or little precious bananas. Ani chayav ladat mahen hatachunot ha'ishiyot shel hayeled ulehit chashev behen. I need to be aware of what are the particular temperament, the IQ, the generation of the child itself, that all those things make a difference. And he writes that the Vilna Gaon on this pasuk of Mishlei has a beautiful explanation of what it means, Chanoch l'nar al pidarko, in that indented paragraph. Chanoch l'nar al pidarko kishuhu odnar, when a child is still very young, make sure to give the child very specific, very personalized care, education, upbringing, guidance. V'az gam kishayaz kin lo yasur mimena. V'hayinyan, ki hadam ef sharlo lishbor darko. A person cannot change their underlying nature. This is where personality psychology would agree with this. A person's personality is something that's stable for life. They can make changes. They could, force themselves a little bit here, a little bit there to bend what they're comfortable with. But the idea is what Chazal referred to as mazel. Now, mazel is a term that we could spend an entire shir on. And when Chazal, and the Vilna Gaon quotes it here in the next paragraph, we'll do this outside. When the Gemara talks about mazel, this is at the end of Masechet Shabbos, the Gemara talks about mazel in terms of constellations. A child who was born under Mars, that's the Gemara's example in the next paragraph, a child who was born under the influence of Mars is going to be a bloody person. So the Gemara says that child has different options within being a bloody person. They could be a mass murderer, that's one option, on career day. You have a pamphlet, being a mass murderer. So mass murder is an option. Or they could be a surgeon. Or they could be a mohel. Or they could be a shochet. Or they could be a researcher who works with blood and DNA and all kinds of stuff. Meaning the underlying nature is there, but the question is, what are you going to do with it? That's what the Gemara says. Let's quote the next paragraph. Look at the last paragraph on the page. The Vilna Gaon explains. A person can take that personality, and if it's for a person when they're older, or for a parent trying to shape a child, the child's personality is stable throughout life. We've noted this before, my wife and I, that our twins, when they were born, they have very different temperaments, very different personalities at young age. And we look back at videos now, 5 years later, and you could still see the personalities. I'm sure people could think about examples where personality in terms of certain type of neediness or a certain type of giggliness or silliness or attention to detail or conscientiousness or friendliness, these things are stable throughout lifetime. The question isn't, so a person has no free will, because if they're born with a certain stable temperament and personality throughout life, then where's the room for free will? There's room for a person to choose. That was the Gemara's example. A person born under the influence of Mars will be bloody and have a certain interest in those types of things, but they could be a tzaddik or a rasha or an average person. On the second line of the last paragraph, a second line on the second on the last paragraph, a tzaddik or rasha or benin, k'mosha amr b'pesach ha-shabbos, that's the Gemara, ha'amad b'madim yia gvar Ashidama, a person born under Mars will be bloody. Amar of Ashi, Yumna, a doctor, Yiganva, a murderer, Yitavcha, a shochet, or a mohel. Beautiful idea that a person's underlying nature is there, but there's a way to capture it. Freud, who lived way after the Gemara and after the Vilna Gaon, referred to this as sublimation. He talked about people who try to channel their unwanted desires into something positive. They say that Freud came up with this idea when he noticed a child who in his youth had been known to dissect animals and cruelly rip off their legs, and the child became a surgeon. The child learned to sublimate their desire for blood and for taking things apart, and found a way to do it in a socially accepted way, a way to make a good living out of it, to become a surgeon. Right? There are ways for a person to take aggression and become a boxer, which honestly is just as bad. I don't understand the difference. But a person could use their talents toward, if they're very physically strong, if they're very physically active, the person is very good with their hands, the person's very good with wires, very good with computers, right? The kid sticks their hand in an outlet, they're going to be an engineer. Wonderful, right? They have a certain electrical tendency, right? What a shock, right? So that's a great opportunity for parents to do that, right? So how young can we start with this? So a kid puts on a stethoscope and we say, they're definitely going to be a doctor. Kid puts on a pair of glasses and we say, they're going to be a researcher, they're going to be a professor, right? So sometimes we think when the kid is young one thing, but the idea is just to be looking out for these things, that they're stable throughout life. And the question is, how do we tap into a child's potential? How do we look at a child and say, what's going to properly fit their needs? And let's look at the next page, on page Yates. The Vilna Gaon explains that Gemara exactly that way. When I always thought about that Gemara, it's always so funny, that the Gemara makes that statement, that a person born under Mars is going to be very, very hot-tempered or very bloody, a very fiery type of person. And Rabbah, one of the Amoraim, makes a comment. He says, hey, I was born under Mars. And Abaye, his Talmud, says back to him, you're kind of a fiery guy. The Gemara ends there, but I imagine he said back to him, what do you mean? What are you talking about? I don't know what you're talking about. There actually is a Gemara elsewhere in Maseches Megillah that talks about drinking on Purim. Gemara doesn't have a necessarily kind story about that you're drinking on Purim. Gemara talks about two Amoraim who are drinking on Purim, and one of them got drunk. What did he do? He slaughtered, he slashed and killed someone else. You know who it was? It was Rabbah. That same Rabbah. The Chassam Sofer makes the connection between the two Gemaras. Yeah, Rabbah was a tough guy. He was a judge. He punished people. He gave malchus to people. He channeled some of his passion into something religious. Maybe on Purim he took it too far, and that story has an interesting end of Tchias HaMesim, okay? Don't try this at home. Yeah, Tchias, drinking on Purim is also religious.
No, they were arguing, right?
They were having a really good time.
Yeah. No, I thought it was arguing over what actually kills the person.
Uh-huh.
It's a hot sword, whether the sword
uh-huh. Yeah.
Really heat. No?
Yeah, sometimes people get really heated in an argument, and bad times to be arguing about swords when you're drunk and when you're talking about the value of that. But we have to think about that idea. The idea that there are certain natures that we're not going to shake off. So we can try to fight against that. Or we can realize that a person's underlying nature really is consistent throughout their life. So he gives an example. We look at the third paragraph on page Yates. L'dugma, yelad shetuchuna sel yos tamid b'tnua, a child whose nature is to be constantly moving. How do you call this in English? Maybe a child has some kind of early signs of ADHD, right? A child is very hyperactive. He writes, "Eif shar lahafoch yelad kazel liyelad shiyoshed al sefer esrim shalos payam." You can't ever turn a kid like this into a book study kind of person who sits and reads for 20 hours a day. In machricham osolaka, the parent has a goal. The child has to be a doctor, so the child has to sit and study from a very young age. Mekalkalim esayel, you are ruining. It's harsh language, but you are butchering that kind of a child. Oma'atimosa, maybe you're actually just killing him altogether. Hayelan holich acharkach, but derech mishalel. The child's eventually going to correct it and do what they want to do anyway. But when they're young, you can force them. Osimasha ola b'dayta, whatever they really believe is right for them. Rachok mimasha hatchunasa shehitchavnu ha'orim. Parents spend the whole time trying to get them to be a book study. You're going to go to college, you're going to go to graduate school, and the kid ends up becoming a wonderful contractor. And they're awesome at being a contractor, but they can't sit still. They're a wonderful engineer, they're a wonderful plumber, they're a wonderful lifeguard, whatever it is, but there's someone who's going to be out there in the world, and the parent tries to force them to just do one semester in college, do another semester in college, just get an undergraduate degree. How much money, how much time, how much pain and suffering are being forced on a child who can't sit still, and it's clearly not where their bend is going to be. That's how the Vilna Gaon explains the end of the pasuk in the next couple of paragraphs. We'll say it outside. Very beautiful. He says, Chanoch lenar al pidarko, the pasuk concluded, gam ki yazkin lo yasur mimena. Even when the child gets older, they're not going to abandon it. Because if you're not mechanich nar al pidarko, you could force a child when they're young and they have no say of their own. They're not going to be big enough or strong enough or wise enough to know that they need something else. So you force them to be a book studier, or they have to run track, or they have to do ballet, or they have to do skydiving, whatever they're offering in curriculars nowadays. You force a child to do something either studious or something physical that they're not really matim for, they're not really fit for. So when they're young, they have to do it because the parent has the say. They force them to the car, they take them for a carpool, they pick them up, and they bring them home. You can force a kid to do that all the time. When they get older, that's not going to last. When they finally have a say, they're going to do what they want to do. They're going to become that computer science person who doesn't need to have good book smarts, and they have great intuitive skills, or become a person who works road work, or whatever it is. The only way, and the Vilna Gaon explains the pasuk so beautifully, the only way for a child to not abandon this path when they get older is to give them the kind of training that's in according to their nature, because when they get older, they're going to do it anyway. You can't force a kid to keep doing something when they're an adult. Adult may start as early as teenage years, or when they're 11, or when they're 8, or when they're 5. Sometimes it feels like they're already an adult. Sometimes they say, no, I'm not going to dance. I'm not going to do that. So you can keep forcing the kid, or you could say, if you want this to be a lifelong edification, or a lifelong skill, or ability, or craft, then it's going to have to be something in line with the child's nature. When the kid is young, we don't know. We throw out the different things at them, and they have different opportunities, but you can start to see, this kid likes art, this kid likes to sing, this kid likes to paint, this kid likes to roll around in the mud. I don't know what that's supposed to mean about him, about her. But, you know, we have to think about some things they grow out of, and some things that they change. I'm going to pause here for a second. Any thoughts about this idea, as we're speaking more abstractly and more generally at this point? Any thoughts about what this means for parenting?
It's very interesting, but also there's a point to society where you have to have basics, where no matter what you're going to do in life, you have to have societal norms. You can't just go after one track. Mm-hmm. You have to have a foundation of a lot of different things, and then you could go into your track.
Where does that end?
Where does what end?
The foundation.
You're right. But
elementary school, middle school, high school, college,
there's a point
graduate
where it
school.
Ends, but it's not just, oh, you're going to be on this track, so that's all you should focus on. You need to have everything in order to be... You'll be more successful if you have a foundation on everything versus just your one track.
That's a really good point, right? Because sometimes we don't really know. A kid could be 5 years old and be really into singing now, but they might hate it in 2 years. Same thing for math and for science and for arts and for computers. They may like it when they're young, even when they're 15, 16, but they may not like it when they get a little bit older. So to give a generalist education is supposed to be about letting someone have a foundation that can not make them start from scratch again if they end up not liking what they've chosen so far. So that's a good point about giving a generalist education and having a child engage in multiple skills or activities because we don't know necessarily what they're going to like. That's a good point. And yet at the same time, maybe there's like a middle path here where for certain things we have to give a generalist education and for certain things to force them into our career path or in our interest, our sports teams, our recreational activities might be stunting them from becoming who they could be. But the other side is very important too, that to deny them education as generalists may not even allow them to take the current skill so far when they get bored of it. And then they have nothing else left. They put all their eggs in the basket. And they have no other foundation in math and reading. That's a really good point. Other thoughts about this concept, this general concept. The Vilna Gaon has a good example, and the bottom we'll do this like an outside, a good example of David HaMelech and Esav. According to the Medrash, when Shmuel HaNavi came to anoint David as king, he couldn't believe that this person could ever be a king. He looks at this person, he says, he has the nature of Esav. He's redhead, he's fiery, he's hairy. And he says, this person can't possibly be a Jewish king. So what was the answer? David HaMelech had the same temperament as Esav? He channeled it to becoming a warrior, to becoming a king. A king has to have a strong will, has to be someone who cares about reputation and cares about respect and is passionate and decisive and forceful and a leader who's going to lead people to battle, to kill the Plishtim or to drive out people who are threatening the Malchus and have people rebel against him and find ways to deal with that. He had a lot of troubles in his life, David HaMelech. And the reason why he was unable to build the Beis HaMikdash is because he had blood on his hands. He was a bloody person. That's different than Esav, who took his talents and his will in a different way. Everyone asked the question of what was Yitzchak thinking? Yaakov sneaks in with the goat, you know, costume, comes in all fours with the horns. That wasn't what he was doing. But Yaakov comes in and disguised as Esav and he tricks his blind father. What was Yitzchak thinking? He didn't know Yaakov was a tzaddik and Esav was a rasha? What was Yitzchak thinking? What was he going to do? So they say, no, he was going to give Yaakov another bracha anyway. He thought Yaakov would be learning, and Esav would be the Zebulun. He would go to work, and he would lead the country, and he would, you know, fend off the enemies. There was a purpose for Esav. He was going to be able to cultivate the land, and be able to build fortified cities, and be able to, you know, build palaces. He was going to work with his hands. Yaakov and Esav, Rav Hirsch has a beautiful piece in that parsha, where he writes, if you raise Yaakov and Esav the same way, you're either going to kill the Yaakov or the Esav. Just like Revolvi about the banana and the apple tree. If you give the same chinuch to Yaakov and Esav, that's what Rav Hirsch writes, may have been a mistake. He criticizes Yitzchak and Rivka, that they tried to turn Esav a little bit into a Yaakov. Oh, he's just going through a rambunctious stage. He's just a little bit mischievous, but he's going to get back on track. They didn't realize maybe Esav needed some more outdoor time. He needed extra recess. Maybe Esav needed some more outdoor toys. He needed an extra jungle gym. He needed to go on trips to, you know, skydiving and to fun zone all the time. He needed more rambunctious training. And if you force an Esav to sit on the same desk as the Yaakov and go to school, then the Esav uses his kocho somewhere else. Chanoch l'nar al pi darko. Even when he gets older, he's going to maintain it. Esav could be an Esav, a good Esav, a David HaMelech type personality, if when he's young, you train him to be the best Esav he could be. But if you try to turn Esav into Yaakov, well then Esav is going to say, forget this, I'm going to be my Esavness without the chinuch, without the righteous motivations, without the self-control, without the way to temper my anger. Very powerful idea. Very scary idea to think that parents can mess up a child from a very young age. Ta-da! It's a scary process. Being a parent is a very scary process. And sometimes we look to the schools. But we obviously can't expect the schools to be able to individuate the education plan. What are those called? IEPs? Right? We can't actually expect the school to really create an individual education plan for every single child. Not possible. Teacher has an assistant that has 20 kids, 15 kids. You can't really expect them to do a perfect job focusing on each needs. A good teacher can tap into something, a child who's more creative, a child who's more verbal, a child who's more artistic, a child who's more athletic, right? So hopefully that the teacher can tap into some of that. At the end of the day, it's the parent's responsibility. This obligation is for a teacher also, but by and large, it's for a parent to think about, where am I sending my kids to school? What skills am I training them in? Because it's kind of like going to a restaurant, right? Like, the restaurant doesn't have everything on it. You can't blame the restaurant for not serving everything. It's a responsibility on the customer to choose the restaurant that suits the needs that they have. Although nowadays it seems like every restaurant has sushi, right? Pizza stores have sushi. Someone told me this, that in the non-kosher world, it's not normal for pizza stores to have french fries.
Yeah.
Fries is a burger thing.
Burgers.
Burgers and fries.
Steak and fries, burgers and fries.
Steaks and fries, burgers and fries, hot dogs and fries. Pizza store, Domino's doesn't have french fries. Pizza Hut doesn't have pizza. Right? There's no way they're going to be serving those things to you. So maybe our kosher stores try to capture everything, right? Every store has sushi, and every store has french fries, and every store has guys, you know, onion rings and poppers. Fine. So they all have that kind of stuff. But by and large, it makes no sense to go to the restaurant and say, the restaurant should cater to all my individual needs. So make me a steak. This is a pizza store. What are you doing? It's not the store's problem. There are different stores. It's the need of the customer to find out what are my individual hunger needs. And how do I find the right proprietor to provide for me the needs that I have according to my mood today, my feelings today, and my general appetite and dietary restrictions? I think the school is kind of the same way. Put a lot of pressure on the school of, they should be doing a better job with my kid. And they should. Why not? Every school could be doing a little better, but every parent could be doing a lot more better. I say this to myself, right? We can't look at the school and say, when they have hundreds of kids in the school and they have dozens of kids in a class, that they should do the perfect job of catering to every kid's individual needs. Some schools aren't right for a particular kid. Some activities aren't right for a particular kid. The coach should know how to give my kid the perfect position on the field to go to his needs. He has a good throwing arm, he's an outfielder. He can barely catch the ball, he'll play catcher, which is an ironic name because the catcher is the one who doesn't have to catch the ball, right? So the coach should know everything. To some extent, yes, the coach should know how to tap into each person's strength. At the end of the day, it's the parent's job to sign up the kids for activities, the right restaurant, the right venue, to tap into the child's needs. Once they're in the school, once they're in the team, they're in the extracurriculars, by and large, you're working with so many other kids, it's not reasonable to expect they're going to do the perfect job. It's not a criticism of schools. It's just not logistically possible for them. But the parent has the one, the two, the three, whatever number of kids. They're the ones who have to make a decision. And just to decide that automatically, every kid goes to the same school in this family, or every kid goes to the same extracurriculars in this family, or every kid gets the same type of lunch plan in the same family. On the parents, really, to do the majority of the chinuch when it comes to individuating. Prove me wrong, or argue back if that doesn't sound right. Sounds right? Makes sense?
It sounds right. The one thing is that, like, the school's job is to make and help kids do well at school, and it's very, like we started saying in the beginning, it's possible school isn't the right thing for certain kids after a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when it gets kind of tough. Parents, I'm sure, it gets very frustrating. They have to get through school. It definitely, I'd say high school, it wasn't with the foundation. Like, everyone tries to get through high school. And that can get really tough for some kids. It's a small amount, but you're just trying to get them through that, and it's just not for them. And the school's like, this is what we're, what all we could do is teach towards, you know, academics as opposed to, you know, the real world. Then he might be a contractor, and he might be the most successful guy in the class, but he's going to be frustrated During class.
Absolutely. In that case, the parents are losing out, the school is losing out, and the kid is losing out. Who's being served by this one-size-fits-all education? I saw this, someone sent me a tweet from someone, like not someone I know, like one of these like funny memes, and someone said, you know, I wish we learned more useful skills when we were in high school. I remember, like, can you teach me how to do my taxes? Like, be quiet and go back to square dancing, you know? Like, these are the things that we're learning in school. Like, why aren't we taught how to do our taxes? I don't know. Why are we not taught how to do our taxes? Or taught what taxes are. W-2, 1099, like, why are we not taught these things? Why aren't we supposed to learn these things? When do we learn about, like, I don't know, home safety? When do we learn about buying a house, what mortgages? When do we learn about these things? Everyone has to, like, figure it out later. We spend zillions of dollars in school and zillions of years in school, and we come out knowing American history, social studies, geometry, trigonometry, A squared plus B squared, quadratic equation. Who remembers the quadratic equation? How many weeks do you spend learning the quadratic equation in school? X squared minus 4ab, whatever it was. Who cares? Why are we focusing on that? All right, to see these points about this general foundation, but we can ask the question, what is decided to be part of the generalist foundation? Why does everyone have to learn trigonometry or physics, but we don't learn basic life skills about finances?
Sure, having like home ec and shop and stuff like that.
I'm not going to call any particular school because I think it's really hard.
I don't think any
should.
I don't think any of them do.
Like, what do you take? Like, there's only so much time.
Nothing. Well, there are
exactly.
There are government requirements, right?
There's a lot of stuff you could take. Is there really?
The government, yes, requires you study trigonometry. You need math 3. Was it math AB and then math 1, 2, and 3, and then back to AB and back to 3? The government requires this. We have to learn geometry. But why? And I'm not really speaking about, you know, reforming the school system at this point, but just for parents to think about this question in general. We're so used to the school system. Everyone has to go. I work in a college counseling center, and this is not unique to where I'm working, but you have students coming in who are clearly not matim, clearly not set up for being in college. This amount of money and time and research spent, it's just not what the child is going to do. The child says, I'm going to be a contractor anyway. And there's some classes for furniture design and things like that are great. But by and large, some of these professions that they're going to do anyway, and they're already doing on the side and making a lot of money doing plumbing or whatever else they're working with their hands and making a phenomenal living. So why does everyone get the same one size fits all? Can we normalize trade schools? Can we normalize children getting something else after college, an apprenticeship?
There's college like this, isn't for everybody.
College is not for everybody.
Right, not after college, before college.
Even before college.
Right.
Right? If a child is not going to finish, child gets a GED and goes for some craft school, which they have some of these, it's like embarrassing in the community to say, why? I'm not looking down and saying, I'm saying I'm part of the problem. I'm part of the same communities as everyone else here. I'm not, you know, saying it's easy to send your
school. School for plumbing or
there are vocational schools at the high school age too for secondary school. So why does it feel uncomfortable? Why does it feel uncomfortable for a child to start early toward a career path that's going to be wonderful for them?
Because Nubby's not taught in the morning.
It's really hard. It's hard to break the trend when parents feel like, my kid's not going to college. And parents are almost apologetic. A kid tried college and just started out going to great job. Why are you apologetic for your kid being a phenomenal contractor? That's amazing. It's not second rate. That's the best thing in the world for them. Child is making a lot of money. They didn't spend useless years in school with useless loans. Hello.
And who's doing their books?
Right?
The guys who were in college.
Right. And the guys who were in college doing their books.
I heard this great saying. The A students end up working for the B students. And the C students own the company.
That's all these stories of adversity, right?
Yeah, it's not true all over the place. But
it's the child who had dyslexia, or child who had ADHD, and has trouble with the books, who finds a way to be resourceful, and they find that a child having a learning disability, like let's say dyslexia, trouble reading, is in no way linked to poor IQ scores. Many times, children with dyslexia are phenomenally intelligent and successful, and they overcompensate because they don't have the reading skills, and they're geniuses, and they're successful, beyond successful. However we measure success, and success is finances or happiness, however we measure successful, but they're doing great, and they're doing what they want to be doing. And they're going to do it anyway. So they could struggle as a lawyer, an accountant, or a psychologist for years and then do what they want to do or never get around to it. That's the Vilna Gaon's point. That's how you explain the pasuk so aptly. Chanoch l'nar al pi darko, gam ki yazkin lo yasa mimena. It's a lifelong journey. It's a lifelong career path only if it fits and works with the child. Otherwise, you're not going to break him. You could force him to sit in a chair for all those years. Take a look at the last page. Page Chaf. I'll just tell you outside a story that he talks about a child who came to his yeshiva, and the father brought him in. My child is so smart. My child loves learning. And he forced the child to come learn. And at the end, he writes that the kid was not set out for learning. The child was forced to learning things and a certain number of hours a day in a yeshiva setting, post-high school yeshiva, that was not for the child. And the child didn't remain religious at all. It's an Aesop-type story. A child who could have been a wonderfully religious and passionate and community-involved Jew who went off the derech because his parent pushed him into learning. You could say it's ironic, or you can say it makes a lot of sense why a child is not fit for that. This one size, not ripping on a Haredi world or yeshiva world more than on a modern Orthodox world. In yeshiva world, there's a one size fits all. Everyone goes to yeshiva X number of years afterwards. And that's great for the kids who it's great for, and it's decent or just a misfit for the kids it's not, and it's very harmful for certain kids. But that's not a critique of the yeshiva system per se, because I think the modern Orthodox system has the same problem when it comes to college. It's just every group likes to have a one-size-fits-all. It's easier, quote-unquote, easier. It's easier decision-wise for parenting. It feels more comforting, and standard-wise, my kid's not going to be in yeshiva? What a busha. My kid's not going to go to college? How am I going to explain it to my shul friends? But what if we normalized for in a yeshiva setting not going to yeshiva afterwards? And learning or being involved in tzedakah or chesed, there's 612 other mitzvahs to get involved in. Maybe shluch hakein is your mitzvah. Go out there and go find those birds. Whatever it is. But it's not a one-size-fits-all. Everyone has to be involved in Talmud Torah. It's a mitzvah of Talmud Torah. Everyone has to be involved. But Talmud Torah is not the same for each person. And how they learn it, people are audio listeners, are they visual learners, are they charusa learners, are they experiential learners with kashrus and halachos. Great! This Torah is so it's almost an insult to Torah and Torah learning to pretend it only can be internalized and made real in a one-size-fits-all type of shir or yeshiva with these types of books or these masechtos or this number of hours a day or in this language or in this format. Why? It's an insult to the Torah to expect it to be a one-size-fits-all. Torah, to be learned every single day, absolutely. By every single kind of person, genders, age, professions, intelligence, absolutely. But if we're going to do one-size-fits-all, it doesn't serve a lot of the kids. And the same thing is true with the profession. It doesn't help people out. It doesn't work well for the institutions. It doesn't work well for the parents. And it definitely doesn't work well for the children. I wanted to share with our last few minutes tonight some more on the psychology side about about personality. I mentioned before about social psychology versus personality. So how do we actually gauge personality in the psychology world? How do we figure out what it is? And hopefully this will be practical in terms of thinking about what factors go into our own, our children's personalities. What factors do we look at? So over 100 years ago, this is an important question. How do you figure out someone's personality, which you can discern in youth and supposedly has this stability throughout a person's life? So you've heard of the Rorschach inkblot test? Remember this at least, right? The classic psychological test. I actually had a year of training in the Rorschach inkblot test. I don't have the cards right here. I left them somewhere else. But this is an example of the card. They have the same 10 inkblots that they've been using for the last 100 years. And you ask people, what might this be?
It's really just the same ones.
The same cards for the last 100 plus years. Right. They don't make up
we
new
all
ones.
We see our mothers.
What?
Right? We all see our mothers.
You don't get what a Freudian slip is, right?
Yeah.
When you say one thing, really you mean your mother?
Yeah, exactly.
Right? So this is the same card. You ask someone, what might this be? Where do you see it? What makes it look like that? Spoiler alert, some of you are not going to take the test. We look at, are they using color? Are they using shape? Are they using texture? Are they using the white space in between? Are they using animals? Are they describing actions? Are they describing things that are impossible, like bears with toes? Right? Are they describing weird-looking things, right? So we kind of, this giant manual is an example of how to score the Rorschach. There's other ways. Now you have a computer. You just put in the answers, and then it just scores it for you. But this is one example of a personality test over 100 years ago, and it's still used. It's a little bit laborious and not necessarily so helpful, except for tracking psychosis, which actually can be very helpful. But personality tests like this are called projective tests. You give an ambiguous stimulus, this ink blot, and you say, what might it be? So here's a good example of social psychology versus personality psychology. Personality psychology is, why do different people respond differently to the same stimulus? So whatever you're projecting onto the, oh, it looks like it's moving, it looks like it's two bears fighting, or it's three cows dancing. Why do they see cows? Why do they see dancing? Why do they see fighting? So it's the person projecting some of themselves and their wishes, their desires, their mothers, right, onto the ambiguous stimulus. That's like an old, classic, ancient Freudian way of measuring personality. That is not the typical way personality is measured. It's very unscientific in certain ways, very haphazard. Started in the 1930s and really worked on until the 1970s, we have what's called now the Big Five personality traits. Heard of this before? Big Five personality traits, and this is typically how personality is measured. I'll give you in a second just a sample you can take home, obviously for your spouse, right, to look at what their personalities are. But the acronym is OCEAN, O-C-E-A-N. So the first, and these are not yes or no, these are spectrums. So one of the Big Five traits is openness. So openness is a person's curiosity, their open-mindedness to try new things, new experiences, new knowledge. People who tend to be high in openness are inventive, they're creative, they're curious. And people who are low in openness are consistent and cautious. Who's better and who's worse? Trick question. It's not better or worse. We're just describing personality types. Temperament. Person isn't yes, open, or not open. It's on a scale of 0 to 100. How open is a person to new experiences? And a certain, I'll give in a second, questions a person could be asked to figure out how open are they to new experiences, new types of learning, new food. Some people go to a restaurant and order the same food every single time. Some people like to try something new. The second one is C, so OCEAN, O-C-E-A-N, so openness. C is conscientiousness, how organized and dependable a person is. People who are high in conscientiousness are efficient, they're organized. People who are low in conscientiousness are more easygoing, laid back. Which one is better? Personality types, right? And there's not yes or no. It's on a spectrum of conscientiousness, rigid versus easygoing, more rigid, more structured versus, kind of go with the flow. E is for extroversion, which is related to how we interact with people. People who are high in extroversion are outgoing, energetic. People who are low in extroversion tend to be enjoying their time more reserved. A person can be introverted, but not shy. Shyness is a person who's uncomfortable. A person could be comfortable and socially comfortable, but prefers to spend time reading a book. Or going for a lonely swim as opposed to a, team swim event or something more at the beach, with a lot of different people. Person gets their enjoyment from different types of activities. A, for agreeableness, how a person feels towards others. People who are high in agreeableness are friendly, compassionate. People who are low in agreeableness are more analytical, detached, they're more into numbers, and they are people, different types of skills. And N is for neuroticism, which is how we relate to emotions. People high in neuroticism are sensitive, tend to be more nervous. People who are low in neuroticism tend to be more secure and stable. I want to pass out just an example of types of questions that can help ascertain a person's personality using this Big Five traits method. And you can take this home. This has been in use already for the last, 50 years at least. Not these exact questions, but these five factors. You see over here, openness for some questions for openness. I see myself as someone who is original, unique, comes up with new ideas, curious about different things. You look at conscientiousness, does a thorough job, extremely careful, reliable worker. For extroversion, full of energy, enthusiasm, loud, outgoing, talkative. You see, for agreeableness, helpful and unselfish, avoiding arguments, always giving in, rarely rude, not liking to rock the boat. For neuroticism, person who can be depressed, person who worries, person who can be moody. And the question is, what do you want to see? You want to see high scores, you want to see low scores? And the answer is, depends what you're looking for. Now, these studies have been done, and very often when a person is in a corporate position, they'll give them a test like this. Some places are looking for high conscientiousness and low neuroticism. They're looking for a person who's very, very structured, very organized, very careful, very meticulous, very thorough, and not so moody, and not doesn't have a fluctuating mood. Other types of jobs would probably not want a person with the exact same skill set. The same skill set for being a banker, for being a hedge fund manager, are not the same skills as being a daredevil. They're not the same skills. They're not the same skill set. What's better and what's worse? Trick question. It's a question of what is right for the person's personality. And on the bottom over here, it gives a great, I read you the summaries of each of these traits, and they give you what's considered to be low, what's considered to be average, and what's considered to be high. You can look at this and think about just more broadly for a child. How is my child in terms of meeting new kids? How is my child in terms of trying new foods? How is my child in terms of new activities, new types of TV shows, new types of clothes? How is my child when it comes to detail? When they're painting, how do they tend to paint? How's my child when it comes to social activities? They prefer to read on their own? They force like, you have to talk to your friends? Why? What if a kid's personality really is to be a lot more book smart, or a lot more book involved? Is that bad? I'm better than the other? No, again, if a child's being rude or not talking to someone, you can gauge them out. Maybe there's a baseline level for social activities as well. Everyone gets a basic social opportunity, and then you see what the kid likes. But to force a child to be involved in loud parties, or loud rooms, or loud music, or loud performances, may not be what the child needs. And perhaps looking at some of these skills, whether it's the exact, you take the questionnaire yourself or give it to someone else or give it to your child or think about it for your child, but just think more broadly. How is my child in terms of emotion? Some children are quick to express, I'm unhappy, I'm sad, I'm frustrated. Some children, they don't give you a clear sense of what they're feeling. And you can look it up. My child tends to be very agreeable, doesn't choose their own activities, isn't really a pioneer when it comes to gameplay, just follows along with the flow. You're going to force a child to be the one to establish new activities with their friends. Some kids are better off as the second or third wheel. They are. Some kids do better as the sidekick. Every TV show needs a sidekick. Right? You can't all be type A. You can't all be the main character of our story. A person who is too much of a non-character in their own life, it's obviously a bad thing. But to some extent, some children need to be more of a follower, be more of a supporting cast member. And there's nothing wrong with that. Obviously, we can't speak too many details. That's the whole point of tonight, that every child is different within a single family and obviously between different families. But hopefully this is some food to think about. To wrap up for tonight, Revolbi gave us this beautiful idea that personality is something stable throughout a child's life and really should influence the type of nurture that the child gets. It really should not be a one-size-fits-all, certainly not for kids in a classroom, which is, again, a limitation of our system, but for the parents to think about which restaurant, which school, which types of opportunities, extracurriculars, am I setting my child up for? Chanoch lenar al pi darko, gam ki yaskin, lo yasum rimena. Child has the opportunity to live a lifelong, meaningful life if the parent is constantly thinking about at a young age, what types of activities or social opportunities or needs am I going to push my child into a social, or recreational, or educational setting that is not good for them, that is causing them more harm than good. And just hopefully, with the OCEAN, hopefully these are some of the factors that we could think about in terms of our children. These are the personality traits for life. And hopefully with this opportunity, we can think about ways to tap into our child's best interest, to be able to promote them to whatever it is, to break down community standards, to be able to do what's best for the child without worrying about what people are going to say. The reality is, this is the best way. Chanoch lenar al pi darko. Mitzvah Hashem, we should all have this, the siyata d'shmaya and the wisdom to be able to give our children specifically personalized education to help them grow up to be amazing adults.